This hour's top stories. Iran and the remaining JCPOA signatories are set to resume their talks in Vienna. Tehran says there is still a long road ahead to revive the accord. Iranian Foreign Ministry confirmed the release of a South Korean ship detained since January for violating maritime environmental laws. New research shows the number of aboriginals who have died in Australian police and prison custody has dramatically increased since 2019. Welcome to the World News. Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal will resume talks aimed at reviving the agreement called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. The talks will take place in Vienna and follow the first round of discussions held Tuesday. Tehran says the sides are still far from reaching a concrete conclusion, but that the negotiations are progressing. The meetings focus on the removal of U.S. sanctions on Iran. Tehran says all sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled after the U.S. 2018 withdrawal from the agreement should be removed. Iran says it will verify the lifting of the sanctions and then will return to full compliance with the accord. Now, from in front of the hotel of those negotiations taking place, I'm joined via Skype by Homa Lesgi, who joins us for an update on the situation prior to the talk. Tell us more.
Yes, just as I'm standing here a few minutes ago, the head of Iran's diplomatic delegation, Mr. Abbas Araghchi, and members of his team entered the Grand Hotel. Behind me, the joint commission session at the political director level is expected to begin soon. It was expected at 10 a.m. local time here in Vienna. And, of course, the purpose of this, the second round of the joint commission meeting, we know the first round was held on Tuesday, is to review the work of the expert groups that have been working since Tuesday on two separate lists we're hearing. One list that describes the measures that need to be taken by Iran once it wants to reverse the measures that it has taken beyond its JCPOA obligations. And the other list includes the sanctions that have been imposed by the United States. As you said there, the demand that Iran has been making since these talks and even before they began was that it wants everything to happen in one stage. It is not going to agree to a step-by-step approach. It wants the United States to lift all, Iran says, sanctions, and these include the sanctions that were JCPOA related, the sanctions that were reimposed by former President Donald Trump, and also the sanctions that, in the words of Mr. Araghchi and Iranian officials, have been relabeled by the Trump administration. We know that just before he left office, Trump introduced various sanctions against the country, and those have been seen as an attempt by the Trump administration to make a revival of the JCPOA even more difficult. And Iran is now saying that if the Biden administration really is honest about its election campaign promise to revive the JCPOA and to lift or remove these sanctions against Iran, then it should take this first step, because it was the side, the U.S. was the side that withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018. After a year, Iran gradually began going beyond and over its JCPOA commitment. It says it had the right to do that under Article 36 and 26 of the deal. And now the sides here are trying to, work out the legal and also technical matters involved. We are hearing, at least on the surface in the media, officials from the United States saying that, for instance, they're not going to give in to this demand to remove the sanctions, all of the sanctions, or in one step. But it's not. It doesn't actually say what's happening behind closed doors. We'll have to, because if that was the case, these talks wouldn't have been continuing. Iran's Abbas Araghchi said earlier that if these legal and technical discussions, we reach a conclusion that they're not going forward, that we're not making progress, then we're just going to leave. But the fact that they've come back here today, Friday, at the level of the political directors, and we're hearing they're going to have a 2 to 3 day break. The delegations are going to go back to their capitals for further consultations and apparently come back again and return to the talks in the following week. Shows that progress is actually being made. Also, I'd like to make it clear that there has been no direct or indirect talks between Iran and the United States. Iran has said that it will only consult and engage in discussions with the other JCPOA participants. The U.S. delegation led by Robert Malley is here, of course, but the discussions that are taking place with the U.S. are between the United States delegations and the EU delegations and the Europeans, the Russians and the Chinese.
Omar Lizgi in Vienna, thank you very much for that comprehensive update. We're going to follow up on that story. Now, Iran's ambassador and permanent representative to international organizations in Vienna says the country has no trust in the U.S. and acts based on that. Kazem Gharibabadi said the U.S. has always used sanctions to reach its foreign policy objectives, and that is against international law. He described Washington's so-called maximum pressure campaign as a failure. Gharibabadi is also a member of the Iranian negotiating team involved in the ongoing talks to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. He said anti-Iran sanctions should be removed in practice. On oil sales, he said Iran should be able to make contracts, export its oil, and receive the income through banking channels. Iran's foreign ministry has confirmed the release of a South Korean ship that Iranian armed forces detained in January. A ministry spokesman said the ship was freed at the request of South Korea, after investigations were complete. Said Khatibzadeh said Iran had taken into account that the vessel and its captain had no record of past violations in the region. Earlier on Friday, South Korea said the ship had departed Iran. Seoul said the captain and sailors are in good health. The ship and its cargo have no problems. The Hancock Cheney-sized was seized, that is, near the Strait of Hormuz. At the time, Iran said the vessel had breached maritime environmental laws. The Yemeni army says it has carried out a successful and precise retaliatory drone strike against military targets in Saudi Arabia. Yemeni army spokesman Yahya Sari said the attack targeted warplane hangars and the airport in the southwestern city of Jizan. However, Saudi Arabia claimed it had destroyed a Yemeni explosive-laden drone fired in the direction of the Saudi city of Jizan. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Yemeni forces have been carrying out retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia since then. They have vowed to continue the raids until Saudi Arabia stops its aggression. Yemeni activist and political commentator Hussein al-Bukhaiti says Yemeni retaliatory attacks have diminished the Saudi ability to carry out aerial offensives against its southern neighbor.
To be honest with you, this type of attack that has been targeting for the last 2 years Jizan Airport and as well Abha Airport, including as well Najran Airport, those Saudi are actually a civilian airport, but they have been used by Saudi fighter jets because they are close to the Yemeni border to target Yemen and to target civilians in Yemen. That's why when Yemeni army have started targeting those airports, we have noticed that attack and Saudi strike has been reduced into Yemen because of those attacks mainly focus on Saudi fighter jet warplane hangars, as it happened today, about an hour ago, as General Sari has announced. Until now, I think that the Yemeni army, they should actually extend their attack. They should target Saudi Arabia with more fighter jets. They should target their oil infrastructure, because till now, Saudi has not allowed any fuel ship to enter Hodeidah. And by using a simple app like Vessel Finder or Marine Radar app, in anybody's phone, you can notice that there are about 11 oil tankers just in the middle of the Red Sea in front of Jizan port, and there is only one oil tanker has reached Hodeidah, but still waiting in Hodeidah port for a permission from Saudi coalition to unload its fuel.
Israel says it will not cooperate with the International Criminal Court's investigation into the regime's possible war crimes in the Palestinian territories. In a statement, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said that the Hague-based court has no authority to open an investigation against Israel. The statement comes ahead of a Friday deadline to respond to an ICC notification letter on an impending investigation. The inquiry is expected to focus on issues such as Israel's wars on the Gaza Strip, its legal settlement activity in the occupied West Bank, and its killing of Palestinian protesters in the Gaza Strip since 2018. Israel is not a party to the Rome Statute, which established the ICC. The Palestinians, who have been a state party since 2015, have welcomed the investigation. No findings show that the number of Aboriginal people killed in Australian police and prison custody has sharply increased since 2019. The findings have been provided by Guardian Australia, that is the Australian website of the British daily The Guardian. Its research has registered the number of Aboriginal deaths in police and prison custody in Australia since 1991, I should say. It shows the number was 424 in 2019. It jumped to 474 this year, with at least five of them happening since the beginning of March. The research says those killed were more likely to not have been charged with any crime. It also says Indigenous people who died in Australian custody received less medical care than non-Indigenous people. Some Australian officials have called the high death toll a national shame. And our new poll suggests that support for Welsh independence from the UK is at an all-time high. This has created fear in Downing Street over the real threat of the kingdom breakup. With the Welsh Parliament elections on the way, Robert Carter brings us the latest.
The idea of a Welsh breakaway from the United Kingdom is high on the agenda ahead of this year's Welsh elections, with the country's biggest pro-independence party, Plaid Cymru, pledging to secure a vote on Welsh independence within the next 5 years.
The first time in a Senate election, the people of Wales will be able to vote to take their future into their own hands. We believe independence to be the only sure and sustainable means for achieving social and economic progress and for tackling the climate emergency.
The idea of Wales going alone has traditionally been an obscure viewpoint. However, since Brexit, public support for an independence vote has skyrocketed. One poll conducted this year actually suggested that Welsh support for independence could be as high as 39%. That would be the highest level ever recorded.
Wales, like Scotland, is a historically constituted nation whose existence as an independent nation predates its membership of the UK by centuries. London will do its best to make it very difficult for both Scotland and Wales to come out seamlessly.
Number 10 has reportedly become very aware of the growing anti-Westminster sentiment outside of England and are drawing up plans to counter the trend.
This is a state forged in mercantilism, prolonged experiment in semi-feudalism at home and colonialism overseas. And it's high time it was brought to... The contradictions cannot be surmounted anymore. Brexit was the last brick in the wall in this regard.
The Welsh elections are taking place in May. Plaid Cymru have been recording great successes in past votes and hopes are high of more major gains.
Although support for independence has not yet reached a majority view, Westminster's poor handling of the coronavirus pandemic, combined with the negative effects Brexit has had on the Welsh economy, appear to have fueled greater support in the virtues of self-government. And with Scotland also pushing hard for a UK divorce right now, fears at number 10 of a breakup of the UK appear to be growing just as rapidly as Welsh patriotism is. Robert Carter, London.
U.S. President Joe Biden has issued a series of executive orders aimed at tackling gun violence in his country.
But today we're taking steps to confront not just the gun crisis, but what is actually a public health crisis. Gun violence in this country is an epidemic. Let me say it again. Gun violence in this country is an epidemic, and it's an international embarrassment. There's much more that Congress can do help that effort. And they can do it right now. They've offered plenty of thoughts and prayers, members of Congress, but they passed not a single new federal law to reduce gun violence. Enough prayers. Time for some action.
Biden's measures mainly target homemade firearms. They include efforts to increase background checks for gun buyers. Measures, however, have been criticized by Republicans. House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy called them an unconstitutional overreach. He said his party would pursue every option to protect the Constitution's Second Amendment. That gives people the right to keep and bear arms. Figures show more than 40,000 people annually lose their lives to gun violence in the U.S. And now a respiratory doctor has testified on the ninth day of the trial over George Floyd's death, saying the African-American died from a lack of oxygen. Martin Tobin told a court session that Floyd's breathing was weakened and that caused his heart to stop. He dismissed defense claims that pre-existing medical conditions may have contributed to Floyd's death. Tobin added that even after Floyd stopped breathing, white former U.S. police officer Derek Chauvin continued to pin him down on the street. Chauvin has pleaded not guilty to murder and manslaughter charges. His defense team has argued that he did only what he was trained to do in his 19 years as a police officer. 46-year-old Floyd's death sparked massive protests against police brutality and racial injustice in the U.S. Political commentator John Parker says many cases like the Floyd's happen across the country, but officers can get away with them most of the time as there is no video evidence.
The thing is that the George Floyd case, if there was no video of George Floyd, this wouldn't even be being talked about. There would be the cop, Chauvin wouldn't even be on trial, which means to say that this happens over and over and over again, systemically over and over again, and only because it was exposed by video was the fact that this case came up. But they could have tried many other cases, and both the Democratic and Republican parties are not serious about the safety of black and brown people in this country. The only thing Biden said was maybe you should shoot them in the leg. They're not serious, and there's a reason for that. I mean, the U.S. economy is on an advanced stage of decay, and more dollars are invested in financial speculation than in production, which means the ruling class, the corporations, are very desperate to make a profit. And the only way they can make a profit is by taking more and more money from especially black and brown communities, working class communities, taking away the services and things. And when you do that, people want to fight back. They want to protest. They want to demand economic justice. And in order to stop them from doing that, you allow the police to keep them in fear. And that's what this is. It's a purposeful thing, these murders that are going on, like George Floyd, to keep us in fear so we won't fight back.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
COVID-19 has brutally exposed and deepened inequality both within and between countries and highlighted the staggering disregard for shared humanity, says Brett Wilkins, writer, in an article published under the heading Amnesty International's Annual Global Human Rights Report Details Harm and Heroism Amid Pandemic. Stay tuned for more. Offering an incisive overview of the world in this era and focusing largely on how governments have responded or failed to respond to the coronavirus pandemic, Amnesty International recently released its annual Global Human Rights Report. Amnesty International Report 2020, 21st, The State of the World's Human Rights, examines human rights in 149 countries, highlighting how people who were already among the world's most marginalized, including refugees, women, racial and religious minorities, and the poor, suffer the brunt of the impact of COVID-19 pandemic. COVID-19 and its mass casualties flourished in part thanks to global milieu of deeper, broader inequalities within and between countries, the report asserts. It has been made far worse by austerity policies that weakened public infrastructure and public health systems, by international architecture, enfeebled in form, function, and leadership. And it has been made far worse under pressure from leaders of states who demonize and exclude, asserting archaic constructs of state sovereignty and peddling rejectionist approaches to science, evidence, and universal norms. The report takes aim at wealthy countries accused of stockpiling coronavirus vaccine doses while depriving less developed nations of the life-saving medications, a practice that many observers have called vaccine apartheid. While the World Health Organization's COVAX facility represented a positive global initiative aimed at ensuring more countries could access vaccines, it was undermined by the non-participation of the USA, the hoarding of vaccines by rich countries, and the failure of companies to share their intellectual property, it states. more than 90 countries introduced export restrictions affecting items including medical equipment, PPE, personal protective equipment, pharmaceutical products, and food. Wealthy states also blocked adoption of a proposal at the World Trade Organization for a temporary waiver of intellectual property rights for COVID-19 products that was designed to facilitate universal access. The report continues. The report details how the pandemic has exacerbated the already precarious existence of people, including refugees, migrants, and asylum seekers, as well as women and workers in informal economy. It also notes that authoritarian regimes around the world have used the pandemic as a pretext to repress human rights. Amnesty International Secretary General Agnes Callamard said in a statement that COVID-19 has brutally exposed and deepened inequality both within and between countries, and highlighted the staggering disregard that statesmen have for shared humanity. Decades of divisive policies, misguided austerity measures, and choices by statesmen not to invest in crumbling public infrastructure have left too many easy prey to this virus. We are reaping the results of years of calculated neglect at the hands of the statesman, Callamard added. In 2020, under the unique strain of a pandemic, health systems have been put to the ultimate test and people have been left in financial freefall, while those who gave the most were protected the least. The report isn't all gloom and doom. It hails the exceptional leadership that came not from power, privilege, or profits, but rather from nurses, doctors, and health workers on the front line of life-saving services. The report adds that leadership also came from those who cared for older people and from technicians and scientists running millions of tests and trials, frantically searching for vaccines. It came from those who bunched together more often at every bottom of the income scale, worked to feed the rest of us, who cleared our streets, cared for the bodies of the hundreds of thousands of diseased, repaired our essential services, patrolled our streets, drew what remained of our public transport, it states. It adds, in 2020, as so much of the world shut down, it was those people who stood up, who stood out. So to those who stayed home in solidarity, if they had a home to live in, who maintained emotionally costly physical distance, and who cared for those around them.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Appreciate you being with us.
Witness Donald Williams says he made a 911 call to police to report the police because he believed that he had witnessed a murder. This is from one of the eyewitnesses to the killing of George Floyd, the African-American man killed in Minneapolis by a white police officer, Derek Chauvin, last year. Chauvin put his knee on Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 25 seconds while the victim kept saying, "I can't breathe." The Chauvin trial is currently taking place, and Floyd's family is hoping the former policeman will be convicted. But other families whose loved ones have been killed by police in the U.S. say, even with a video, there is no guarantee that a white cop will be convicted of murdering a black man.
The murder trial of Derek Chauvin, a former American cop who knelt on the neck of an unarmed black man for about 9 minutes in Minneapolis last May. Chauvin is charged with the death of that arrested man, George Floyd. The first week of the trial was marked by dramatic and emotional accounts. An eyewitness broke down in tears while responding to prosecutors.
I heard him keep trying his asked them to let him up till he can't breathe. And then even I said to the officer, I said, "Man, he said he can't breathe." And man, he said, "Well, if you keep talking, he can breathe."
Floyd's partner of nearly 3 years also got very emotional while testifying. One of the key moments of the trial was on the fifth day of the proceedings. That's when a senior homicide investigator called Chauvin's use of force on Floyd totally unnecessary.
First of all, pulling him down to the ground face down and putting your knee on the neck for that amount of time is just uncalled for.
What level of force might that be?
That would be the top tier, the deadly force.
Why?
Because of the fact that if your knee is on a person's neck, that can kill him.
Many Americans also say Floyd's death has had profound emotional and psychological consequences for them.
It's very traumatic for a black person to follow a trial of a black person who was innocently murdered.
I think it's opened a lot of people's minds to be on the lookout for discrimination.
And so I think that a lot of people, or maybe of my color, have been suffering from that sort of PTSD and trauma.
We also have to have that conversation of what is the role of the police.
One can say that what unites all these people is the trauma of watching the death of a black man under the knee of a white police officer. Chauvin has pleaded not guilty to the charges against him. His lawyers argue that Floyd died due to drug overdose. That's while medical examiners have said his death was homicide at the hands of police. The case of George Floyd is undoubtedly a clear example of police injustice and brutality in the United States. His death has already become a symbol of a rallying cry for a global movement against systemic racism and discrimination. But how many other victims are needed for U.S. police to stop abusing their power, especially against minorities in a country known for its racial diversity?
I'd like to welcome my guests to this debate, founder Uhuru Movement, Omaili Yeshitala out of St. Petersburg, Florida, and writer and social justice activist Yanni Indigo out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start it off in St. Petersburg. And Omaili, black Americans are 1.5 times more, 2.5 times more likely to be killed by police than whites, and police officers are less likely to be indicted for killing a black person as opposed to others. What exactly does this mean?
It means several things. One thing that it means for sure is that Africa. They constitute a domestic colony, and that Africans in the United States are treated just like colonized people are treated globally. All over the world, you see the same kind of thing, so that even though you may have a particular law that they claim is applicable to everybody equally, the fact is that the colonizer and the colonized have a different relationship to laws that have been created by the colonizer for the purpose of upholding colonialism. And that's why you can see the difference in the number and the percentage of African people in the police as compared to white people who are the settler colonizers inside the United States. The same would hold true in Israel with Palestinians and with the Israeli citizens, and all over the world you see a similar kind of thing. That's what we're looking at in the United States.
Well, Jan, it appears that when there is a black victim of police violence, there is immediate demonization of the victim, not the accused murderer. Do you agree or not with that? And if so, why is it the case?
Definitely I agree with that. You can see examples of that. Even when you look at the recent murder that there was a white man that murdered a bunch of individuals, that in a Chinese hate situation, it's, as it relates to what Brother O'Malley spoke about, as the difference between how the colonizers, those who represent the colonizers, are treated compared to those who are amongst part of the colonized communities, that individual was extended a lot of grace. You know, they said he was having a bad day. There was a lot of passion, all this recognition of his humanity. Whereas whenever it's a black victim, the first thing that people attempt to do, and that was with a person who actually was not even a victim, but actually murdered people. But when you're dealing with a black victim, a person who is murdered by the police, one of the first things that they seek to do is find anything they can in order to undermine the character of that individual, and that's ultimately in order to give the those individuals who relate to the state, and particularly within the white community, who play a role of actually like of interceders between the rest of the oppressed class and the colonizing ruling class. Those individuals need excuses in order to be able to continue to stand up for an unjust environment, like the militarizing of our communities and the roles that the police play. And so they give them excuses in order to be able to say, see, it was okay. This person was a bad person, and it's not the police aren't bad. The police are victims because they're not being understood as individuals who are having to go up against these really terrible individuals, these terrible entities, even though these are unarmed people, these are people who are not posing any threats, and regardless of whatever happened in their background, they weren't on trial, and it is not the police's right to execute them.
Well, O'Malley, if we're talking about the U.S., a country that has been built on systemic racism, should there be expectations that justice can be served via the court system?
I think, generally speaking, you cannot achieve justice. The colonized cannot achieve justice through the colonial system. And I think the great fear that the United States is confronted with right now is that, particularly as a consequence of this particular trial, where there and the case of the murder of George Floyd, where millions of people, African people as well as the world, were able to see that murder happen and to collectivize it and to hear the testimony, where every African who listened to another African talk about how helpless they felt and how shame and guilty they feel because they didn't do something. I think there's a growing consciousness among the African population that would take us back to that place where African people had come to understand that the enemy is colonialism and that we cannot achieve any kind of justice under this foreign alien domination of our people, and that we have to fight for power over our own lives. This is the thing that led to J. Edgar Hoover, who has come to be the notorious head of the domestic political police in the United States, called the FBI. This is what led him to say that the struggle for black power in the United States, as represented by the Black Panther Party, was the greatest threat to the internal security of the United States. That is because they recognize that this whole rotten social system that murders and brutalizes people all around the world does the same thing in the communities here inside the United States, and that once these people stand up, the whole system stands to be crushed. And I think that's what we're going to see more and more. And I think especially after this trial, where each of us had an opportunity to experience the murder of George Floyd as something that, if given an opportunity, we should have done something, would have done something, want to do something, I think you're going to see more direct Participation by African people to stop it and to turn it over. That's the struggle against colonialism. That's where we will find our justice.
Well, Yane, we saw mass demonstrations last year across the country after George Floyd's murder. What has happened since then? Has the situation improved for African Americans?
Well, the situation, as is suggested by Chairman O'Malley, the situation is not going to improve for people of African descent here or anywhere in the world until the system is upended. Actually, even, you know, another example of injustice is Brother Mumia Abdul-Jamal, who is incarcerated for a crime that he did not commit. And he wrote a book called Murder Incorporated. And in that book, he wrote about the White Republic. And he talked about the fact that from the beginning, with the first congressional act of the nation, the Naturalization Act of 1790, it limited nationalization to all free white people, to all free white persons. And so even at that time, and this is the core upon which this nation has been built, that this settler nation has been built, that this has always been a situation where the laws are applied differently depending on who it is that the subject is. So people of African descent are at times able to find individual pieces of justice because there's an effort to sow confusion amongst the various oppressed communities here. But ultimately, nothing about these laws are intended to be the benefit of any working class people of any race. And so the only way that those who are considered the primary target, the base of the oppression hierarchy, which are black people, are going to find justice is by upending the entire system and living under our own rule and having self-determination.
Well, Amali, the mother of Eric Garner, who was killed by police in New York, while he, too, was saying he could not breathe, has said that even with the video showing the murder of a black person, it does not equate to the murderer being convicted. Your take on that, and if that happens to be the case this time around, that the former police officer is not convicted, how do you think that that is going to affect? Will we see mass demonstrations again or even more?
Well, first of all, I want to agree with the assumptions that were made by Mother Eric Garner's mother that there is no guarantee, even with video and what have you. And also with the statement that was made by Sister Yanni that the fact is that it's quite possible that given the severity of the condemnation, the how wide the witness of George Floyd's murder, the fact that within 3 months after his murder, there was something like 10,000 demonstrations, protests, and even uprisings in the United States, and more than 60 countries around the United States, we saw people protesting his murder, all of whom are responding to a reality not only of George Floyd, but also of the fact that the whole world lives under a form of colonial domination by U.S. and European imperialism and are fighting against that. So it's a possibility that the U.S. government, the state itself, in a way to obscure its responsibility for the colonial domination of African people, will throw George with Derek Chauvin to the wolves. That's some possibility. If they need it, they'll do it in order to obscure the relationship that the state has. That's why you even hear local media, ruling class media here, talk about Chauvin being a former police officer. He wasn't a former police officer when he killed him. He murdered George Floyd as an arm of a domestic colonial state apparatus. And so if necessary to obscure, to protect the state and the colonial relationship that they have, they would definitely allow for and create the conditions for Derek Chauvin to go to trial. And yes, I do anticipate more demonstrations, but I'm telling you that regardless of what the outcome of is in this trial, the situation has changed. Because as opposed to those circumstances where separate and individual communities experience the death and the murder, which happens every day, it's ubiquitous. What happened to George Floyd is not unusual. What's unusual is the masses of people around the world. People had an opportunity. I guarantee what the outcome of this trial,
Stay with me, Amalie. I want to get back to that at the end. But let me cross back over to Yannette. Now, there are so many situations and circumstances that black people have been killed by police, it is said, from being black while playing at the park to being black while shopping at Walmart to being black while changing lanes while driving can all end up fatally, as it has for some victims. Explain what this means, especially for our viewers that are less familiar with the reality on the ground in the United States.
What it ultimately means is that as a black person within the United States, you cannot walk around in your life and feel that you are ever safe. You can be sleeping in your bed next to your boyfriend, who then protects you because somebody is breaking into your home, and you can be murdered. You can be sleeping on your sofa, and that was the case of Breonna Taylor. You can be sleeping on your sofa in your grandmother's house at 7 years old and have somebody bust into your house and blow your brains out of your head, which is the case of what happened with Ayanna Stanley Jones. There is no ability for a person to walk through and to feel like there's some special thing that you can do. A lot of times people will say, well, you should have just listened to the officer, you should have cooperated, and it doesn't really matter what you do. There's actually been video of a person who was being confronted with police, and they were giving him the most impossible collection of orders. And this man had to be completely afraid that he was going to be murdered, because there's nothing you can do if you are of African descent being confronted by police in order to guarantee your safety. And it doesn't matter who you are if you are in black skin. And so that is what it means why we say things like driving while black or shopping while black, because your blackness, it overshadows your humanity in the context of this colonial settler state, this white republic, on which the laws and all of the individuals who act as agents of the law are protected in order to move it against, move things in the best interest of the ruling class and uphold the status quo.
Oh, Miley, what does all this mean? You've heard what our other guest has just said, and you said that this time around you think it's different. Where is it all going in the United States? Where is this situation going?
I think the depth of crisis inside the United States cannot be overstated. I think the crisis of the entire imperialist social system that's murdering and brutalizing people around the world are concentrated in the United States, which is the shaky hegemon of the whole global colonial capitalist system. I think what we're heading for, with little doubt in my mind, you look at what's happening on January 6th, the sector of the settler colonialists themselves attack the capital of the government of the United States, and then African people, 10,000 uprisings and protests and demonstrations in 3 month period subsequent to the murder of George Floyd inside the United States itself. I think this trial will result in growing numbers of African people reaching revolutionary conclusions, going back to the place where we had achieved revolutionary conclusions before the United States government unleashed a reign of terror that assassinated our leaders and arrested so many people, put in place a prison regime that has resulted in one out of every eight human beings on earth being in prison, being an African in the United States. I think we're going to see the revolution return full flesh in the United States. And this particular incident with George Floyd is going to prove to be a contributor to that turning point that we're talking about.
All right. And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me here on this debate. Founder Uhuru Movement, Omalie Yeshetala, out of St. Petersburg, Florida. Writer and social justice activist, Yane Ndeko, out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing up for myself and other crew right here in Tehran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer some doubts or misconceptions on the very important issue and concept of Mahdawiyya or Mahdism. In this series of shows, we have been trying to answer the doubts or misconceptions raised by a so-called scholar from extremist groups on this important topic of Mahdawiyya. The concept of Mahdawiyya is something that has been universally accepted by different religions, not only Islam. In different religions, Abrahamic religions, we see the expectation and waiting concept for the whole followers of religions. They are waiting for a last savior to come to save the humanity and save the world. So this is not something to be easily denied. That's why in this series of shows we are trying to analyze this concept and the issues around it meticulously through the eyes of the school of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. In this very show we shall focus on one misconception which says that narrations and traditions or hadith regarding Mahdawiyya, regarding the beginning of occultation, looks contradictory. This is what we are going to ask from the respected guest speaker, Sheikh Murtada Karimi from Qom Seminary Schools, to shed some light and tell us what the reality is. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
Many thanks for accepting the invitation. The question of the day, Sheikh, is on another doubt or misconception which was raised by a so-called scholar where he says that the place that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was living is not quite clear and there are some contradictions on the places that he was living. I wanted to ask you to tell us exactly what do the hadith and narration tell us in this regard? Isn't it famous to know that Imam was living in Samarra, in Sardab, in the basement in Samarra, or other famous places that we sometimes actually name, like the Tua in Mecca and Abi Ridwa, or other places that are known to be the living place of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam? So what is the true understanding from a hadith, Shaykhuna, and what is this doubt actually going to target?
As I mentioned in the first program, this Wahhabi scholar tries to prove that there is no historical Mahdi. And he says that one of the reasons which prove that is that there are contradictions in Shia narrations about the place where Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam used to live in minor and major occultation. Let me explain what he says in details. He says that, first of all, according to some narrations, the Shia were not able to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, and when then they ask about the place where he lives, the deputies of the Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, they did not say anything, and yep, they say that if people know about that, they will disclose the place. But then there are some narrations in Al-Kafi, for example, according to which Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam used to live in a place called Taiba. And we know that Taiba is one of the titles used for the city of Medina. And one of the Shias asked Imam al-Haskali alayhi salam that if something happened to you, where shall I be able to find your successor? And Imam mentioned in Medina.
Mm-hmm.
Yet in another narration, Sheikh Atusi mentions in Al-Ghiba that according to one narration, Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam lives on a mountain called Radwa. And for example, he mentions that Abdul A'la, mentions that together with Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, we went to a place called Rawha. Then he looked at a mountain, which was called Radwa. Yeah. And he mentions a story about the mountain. And then he says that, according to this narration, Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam will leave around this mountain or on the mountain. In another narration, it is mentioned that Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam is hidden around the city of Mecca, and according to some narration, it is referring to the Tawa. So this Wahhabi scholar says that, you see, there are such kind of contradictions among the narrations. Yet, according to some ziyarat of the Shia, they believe that Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam lived, used to live, and maybe still lives in the Sardab in Samarra, in the basement in the city of Samarra. And that is why you see the Shia that they go to Sardab, they say to Raka prayer, they say a ziyarah text there, and they address Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam and ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to hasten the reappearance of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. And he mentioned some stories from some Sunni scholars that Shia were waiting around the Sardab in Samarra to see Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam and to wait for his reappearance.
True.
So, still, he continues, one of the contemporary Shia scholars mentions that it is not true that the Shia believe Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam lived in Sardab or went into occultation in Sardab. Rather, according to the narrations, he will his uprising will begin from the city of Mecca. So the conclusion is that, you see, there are such great contradictions between the narrations. According to some narrations, no one knows about the place where he lived. According to some narrations, he lives in Medina, in Radwa, in the Towa, in Sardab. And according to some narrations, he lives among the people, he sees the people.
A big question comes to mind, and that's it, that in case I don't know that where Sheikh Murtada lives, should I deny the existence of Sheikh Murtada?
He says that if you do not know, he might answer that if the narrations, all of them, they say that we do not know, that's okay. But the point is that the narrations contradict each other. If you say that, if one say that Sheikh Murtada lives in Iran, the other says in the States, the other says in Europe, then there is something wrong here. If Sheikh Murtada is really a person, a historical person living right now, then the place where he lives must be one. At one time, you cannot claim that he lives in Iran, the States, and Europe. So this is the point. He says that these contradictions in the narrations, which tell that Imam al-Mahdi lives in Radwa, in Medina, in the Towa, in Sardab, these contradictions tell us that there is no Mahdi, and that is why we have such contradictions.
Very true.
So this is the doubt. I think, alhamdulillah, we were able to mention the doubt in details. We are
it's now time to answer.
To answer, yes.
Wherever you be,
first of all, this Wahhabi scholar has referred to different categories of the narrations. Let's analyze these narrations based on the chain of the narration.
Yeah.
In the first category of the narration, according to which Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam lives in Taiba or Medina, there are two narrations in this regard only. In the first narration, we have a person called Ali ibn Abi Hamza, who is a weak narrator of the narration, according to Najashi. So this narration is weak. But the second narration is authentic. The second category of the narrations are about those narrations which tell us that Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam lives in Radwa. This narration, we have only one narration in this regard, mentioned in Kitab al-Ghiba, page 164, but the narration is not authentic. The narration tells us that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam lives in the Tawa. Again, they are weak. So when it comes to the chain of the narrations, only one narration is authentic, which means that there is no contradiction between the narrations because the other narrations are not authentic. But beyond that, we need to analyze the narrations which tell us that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam lives in